Genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turn now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Hi, this is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're live every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. You can also hear us streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura County. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is smart radio with sharp questions aimed at intelligent guests. It's talk radio done right for the 21st century. If you want to join in the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008. Or if you're outside of the area code, it's area code 805-639-0008. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is leaders. Each of my guests is discussing leadership or a leader in his particular field. My first guest celebrates mathematics by looking at a leader in the field, Euclid. He'll take us on an awe-inspiring journey of the world of numbers from his book, Here's Looking at Euclid. My second guest is a documentary filmmaker and author who has also worked at the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles. His work includes Modern Marvels Apollo 11 for the History Channel. This week marks the final voyage of the Space Shuttle program. We'll discuss what's next for NASA and the future of manned space exploration. My third guest asks the age-old question, why are we bad at picking good leaders? He's looked at hundreds of attributes of a leader to determine the ones that are most reliable predictors of good leadership. Just in time for the 2012 elections, we'll discuss a better way to evaluate leadership potential from his book, Why Are We Bad at Picking Good Leaders? And as always, if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Alex Bellos was born in Oxford. He grew up in Edinburgh and Southampton. After studying mathematics and philosophy at university, he joined the Evening Argus in Brighton as a trainee reporter. Alex joined The Guardian back in 1994 as a reporter, and in 1998 moved to Rio de Janeiro, where he spent 5 years as the paper's South American correspondent. Since 2003, he's lived in London as a freelance writer and a broadcaster. Some of the books that Alex has written includes Football, The Brazilian Way of Life, Pele, an autobiography, which he ghostwrote, and Here's Looking at Euclid here in the United States. In 2003, Alex presented a 5-part series on Brazil to the BBC called Inside Out Brazil, and his short films about the Amazon have been broadcast on BBC, More 4, and Al Jazeera International. Welcome to the show, Alex. How are you today?
Hi, I'm very good. Calling from London here.
Yes, you are, and we're cutting into tea time, so thank you very much for being our special guest here on Brainstorming. Now, your book is fascinating because it's an introduction to mathematics, explaining basic mathematical concepts and mixing in a little history there, but it's targeted at readers with no mathematical background. So here's my question for you. You know, if you can't read, you're considered illiterate. If you can't use numbers, you're considered innumerate. So in fairness to all of those who are numerate, numbers were not innate to human beings. So kind of give us the overview of numbers in human history, if you will, Alex.
Well, everyone assumes that numbers have been around since the year dot, sort of always. They've always been there. And, you know, when we grow up, when we're born, when we're taught numbers, it's one of the first things that we learn. But when I was researching my book, I realized that numbers are a really, really recent invention in human history, maybe only about 8,000 years old. And so our brain hasn't actually kind of evolved since numbers have come along to adapt to numbers. And that's one reason why we find numbers quite difficult. And, you know, I thought that everyone would have numbers, but actually there are quite a lot of communities still, people in the Amazon and the outback of Australia, that don't have numbers yet. And the way they think of numbers is very different to how we think of numbers. Because we assume that it's normal. So when you say count numbers, you put them on the number line, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. They're all, the distance between them is all exactly the same. But These people, these tribes in the Amazon, when you kind of test them about their number competence, they think that the higher you get, the closer this number get together. They have what's called a logarithmic understanding about numbers. And what is interesting is that we in the modern world, we're taught the way that numbers are. They're exact. They're evenly spaced. But our kind of our gut feeling, our intuition, is that numbers somehow kind of get smaller as they get higher. I mean, when we talk about a millionaire or a billionaire, we often sort of interchange them as if it just means kind of very rich. But actually, that's the difference between one and a thousand. One is 1,000 times bigger than the other one. And, you know, we'd never mix up one pint of beer with 1,000 pints of beer. So what that shows is that we kind of, one reason why we get confused is that we have the sort of intuition that goes against what we're taught at school, which is kind of fascinating and revealing, and most people don't realize it.
We're talking to Alex Bellis. Alex, I think it's fascinating, and I took a little bit of heart in the fact that there are monkeys and chimpanzees out there that can count. So tell us about counting monkeys, if you will.
Yeah, well, chimpanzees are, firstly, not monkeys. And
true.
When you go to, you know, I didn't realize, I just used that name, I didn't change it the whole time, but when you go and you meet academics that study chimpanzees, because chimpanzees are so close to humans, if you accidentally call a chimpanzee a monkey, you get really, really offended. Like you said something that, you know, that you really, really can't. And about in the 1970s, people wanted to find out how close are chimpanzees, what can they do that is what we can do. So in America and in Europe, where people are interested in language, you know, can chimpanzees understand language? But that didn't really work out. Chimpanzees can't really teach them language. It's a bit controversial. Whereas in Japan, what they did, they tried to teach them numbers. And what they did is that they used touchscreen screens, and they would set these tasks on these screens, and the chimpanzee just had to sort of touch them, and if they got the answer right, they'd get a little bit of food, would like ping down, and if they got it wrong, they'd get no food. So it was reward driven. They'd want to get the tasks right. So what kind of tasks did they ask? They were taught the aspects of numbers. So numbers have two concepts behind a number. You have the amount. So when they were shown a three dot, they would be shown a bunch of digits, and they'd need to touch the number three to get the food. Or if they were shown the number three, and they were given lots of different boxes with one with two dots, one with three dots, one with four dots, they'd have to touch the one with three dots so they'd know what was the digit three. Well, they got that quite easily. And then number is not just amount, it's order. Because when I say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I'm not counting one thing, then two things, then three things. I'm counting, you know, three is defined by being in the order what comes after two and before four. Mm-hmm. So the chimpanzees were, they were shown digits on the screen, and they had to tap the one that was the lesser digit. And this they learned sort of quite quickly as well. So what the chimpanzees were able to do is that they were able to distinguish the amount and the position of the Arabic numerals on a computer screen. And they managed to do that about 20 years ago. So for the last 20 years, the Japanese have been researching with these these numerate chimpanzees. And what I think is sort of fascinating is that they taught the chimpanzees how to use the digits from 1 to 9, so they knew the amount that 1 was, 2 was, 3 was, and they also knew the order. They could tap the lowest and everything. But then the academics, they realized, oh, we haven't taught the number 0. They thought, well, why don't we teach the chimpanzee the amount that is 0, i.e. 0 is when there's nothing there, and see if the chimpanzee can deduce that 0 on the number line is less than 1. Now, this is something that as humans is kind of obvious to us, but it's not obvious to a chimpanzee. And when they did the test to see where did the chimpanzee put 0, chimpanzee put 0 between 6 and 7.
Between 6 and 7? Interesting.
So obviously, we think there's this great connection with numbers, order.
Uh-huh. Alex, you're breaking up there. I can hardly hear you. And I want to talk about the story of Zero because it's a very important story. We're going to try to reconnect with Alex in Great Britain. We're obviously having transatlantic telephone issues right now. But when we get him back on the phone, Zero is a fascinating concept. And he was just getting to the meat of the matter with the Japanese chimpanzees and the number Zero when we lost connection with him over there in Great Britain. When we come back, we will talk about it because Zero is actually a relatively new concept even within the world of numbers. And this might surprise a lot of people, but we owe the importance of the number zero to the Islam religion as well, because it was Islamic mathematicians who developed and discovered the concept of zero. So when we get Alex back on the line, we will continue our discussion about this subject of zero. We've been talking with Alex Bellows, author of the book, Here's Looking at Euclid, From Counting Ants to Games of Chance, An Awe-Inspiring Journey Through the World of Numbers. And we have Alex back on the phone. Alex, we lost you there just as you were getting to the fun part about zero. So let's talk about that. Chimpanzees in Japan that were trained for this actually placed zero between the numbers 6 and 7, and that's where we lost you.
That's right. So the point is, as humans, we understand that numbers are both amount and position, and we can go from one to the other. We know that zero is less than one because we can convert order into position. But chimpanzees cannot do that at all. They seem to be absolutely clueless as to the position of one, of zero, even though they know the amount. And you know, so this shows the limits of sort of chimp kind of brain power. They can manipulate digits on screen, but they can't sort of transfer from this idea of amount to this idea of position.
Oh, well, it's fascinating. Now, since you brought up zero, I did want to go there. So let's talk about that, because your book actually begins with chapter zero, which is fitting because the invention of zero is really important in mathematics and ultimately changed the world. I was telling listeners while we were missing, I was telling listeners that we owed the value of zero to actually to Islam brought that to us. So why was the invention?
I would say not really Islam. It was Hinduism, if anything.
Oh.
We call it Arabic numerals, but actually the Arab world got them from India. And really, it was the Hindu religion that kind of inspired zero. You know, the Greeks didn't have zero. The Egyptians didn't have zero. The Romans didn't have zero. When we learn Roman numerals, there's no symbol for zero.
Right.
Why is that? Why did it emerge in India? It emerged in India, to cut a long story short, because it's the mathematical interpretation of a religious idea. India is where nothingness is something. You know, if you've ever gone to a yoga class, you've got to kind of just let go. This idea that just giving everything away, that nothingness is something, that when the void, which in the Western world we were terrified by, and we put God there, they sort of just let everything go. And it was in that culture that they thought, well, let's think about that mathematically. If nothing can be something. And so they invented this symbol. And the symbol, the circle for zero, is there. And what it means, it's the eternal cycles of the faces of heaven. So it's kind of everything and nothing is the same thing. And this system was, like, fantastic and was adapted by the Arab people trading with India. And then it's through the Arab lands that it came to Europe, who we thought it was Arabic. So we called it Arabic numerals, but actually it's Indian numerals.
Well, there you go. Fascinating information from our author, Alex Bellows, author of the book, Here's Looking at Euclid. And Alex, we're going to bounce back and forth. I'm going to bounce back to Japan now, if I can. You were talking about the Japanese chimpanzees. But in your book, you spent a lot of time exploring Sudoku in your book, which I naturally associate with Japan. What are the mathematics behind Sudoku? And talk to us about that puzzle, because first of all, explain it for some of my listeners who might not know what it is, and then talk to us about Sudoku.
Okay, Sudoku, if you do have listeners who don't know what Sudoku is, they're probably at the bottom of a cave somewhere, because it's probably the most, you know, popular puzzle of sort of the last few years. I don't know in the US, but in the UK, every single newspaper has at least one Sudoku every day. And what it is, it's a grid, a 9x9 grid, where some numbers are filled in, and you need to deduce the other numbers and fill it up, so that every line and every column, so every row in every column has the digits from 1 to 9 once only. So there's only one space for a 1 and a 2 and a 3 and a 4 all the way up to 9. Now, this was a puzzle that was initially invented actually by an American in the late 70s. I mean, he sent the idea, he was an amateur puzzle designer, sent it to a puzzle magazine, but it really, you know, no one really noticed it. It was only because a Japanese sort of puzzle enthusiast got this puzzle magazine, didn't understand any of the other puzzles because they were all written in English, apart from the one which was just numbers, and he thought, oh my God, that's a great puzzle. I'll readapt it. So he put it in his magazine, coined the phrase, you know, registered the phrase Sudoku, which means the number will appear only once, and put it in his magazine, which started to do quite well in the 1980s in Japan, but it still didn't do that much. It was only when in the, I think it was, yeah, it was about 10 years ago, when he's a New Zealander, was in Japan, and the same thing happened. He bought this puzzle book, didn't understand anything that was in Japanese, but saw this great number puzzle and thought, my God, that's brilliant. He worked out what it was, and it was through him that he then launched it in the UK, and now it's something like 100 million people do a Sudoku every day. Now, the Sudoku is interesting mathematically because this idea of having a grid where the numbers appear only once in every row and every column is what's called a Latin square. And Latin squares are something which were invented a few hundred years ago and have lots and lots of actually practical applications. For example, one application which was invented by about 100 years ago is for kind of testing pesticides or testing crops on different areas. If you turn your land into a big grid, then you could make sure that each bit has sort of, you could spread it out in a way so you can work out which pesticide works best or which crop works best, depending on what land it's on. It's also a way of working out fixtures in round-robin sports tournaments. And there's also a bit of kind of sort of cryptography and sort of code breaking or putting codes is also in there as well, because what you have with Sudoku is you have a kind of half the information there, and you need to work out sort of the entire information. So Sudoku is a fun little game that we all enjoy, but actually has a rich mathematical history.
And it's a fascinating story, one of the many fascinating stories in the book. Here's looking at Euclid, from counting ants to games of chance, an awe-inspiring journey through the world of numbers. We've been talking to the author, Alex Bellos. The book is really written for people who are not mathematically inclined. You pick this up, it's a fun read. Alex, what do you want people to take away from reading Here's Looking at Euclid?
I want people to realize that math is entertaining and it's fun, and it's really relevant. I mean, what I did in this book that is different to maybe other books about math, because I'm a former foreign correspondent, is I spent a year traveling around the world, having all these experiences, meeting lots of different people and chimpanzees, and just to bring it out. You know, what I wanted to do, in the way that the guys who did Freakonomics made economics exciting, I wanted to make math exciting. And I think that, you know, if you like math or don't like math, you'll get something from my book. You might not even realize that it is math. It's just entertaining, interesting stories that make you think about the world we're in.
That it is. We've been talking to Alex Bellos, author of the book Here's Looking at Euclid. Alex, thank you so much for being my special guest and taking time away from your dinner and your family. We'll be talking to you down the road.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.